Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where shoppers can share some holiday cheer this season by purchasing a gift card during the Harmon's Holiday Gift Card Sale. In stores only, November 28th through December 1st.
Wallace Stegner was one of the best interpreters of the American West. He wrote novels and biographies and histories about the place. In books like Mormon Country, The Gathering of Zion, Angle of Repose, he explored the landscape of the region along with the myths and the moral tensions. In a new compact biography, the writer and journalist Alex Beam explores the complicated legacy of Stegner's life and work. And it turns out many of his ideas about the West were formed during his years in Salt Lake City, where he came of age, living among the Latter-day Saints. Salt Lake City is one of the central settings for Stegner's first major success, his novel, The Big Rock Candy Mountain. The book follows the wandering Mason family across the northern plains and into Utah. And the main character is a restless drifter and opportunist, modeled on Stegner's own father. Stegner said he invested a lot of himself in that story. Here's Alex Beam.
Wallace Stegner was a young, struggling academic, selling stories for money, eating food out of cans, barely supporting his wife and young son, and spending all of his late 20s and early 30s working on what he would perceive to be his magnum opus, The Big Rock Candy Mountain, the title of which is kind of a slur, like a negative homage to his father, George Stegner, whom he despised. George Stegner was always sort of pursuing the fast buck, the Big Rock Candy Mountain at the end of the horizon. And the narrator of the Big Rock Candy Mountain is Wallace Stegner as Bruce Mason, the son. But the big story is about Beau Mason, a.k.a. George Stegner, Wallace's father.
He was a man who never knew himself, who was never satisfied, who was born disliking the present and believing in the future. He was not, by any orthodox standard, a good husband or a good father. He chafed against domestic restraints ruled by violence instead of love, forced his wife and children to live a life they despised and hated.
Beau Mason is a boomer, a dreamer, a Maine chancer, the type of person who would strip off the side of a mountain looking for gold, fail, move next door and strip off the side of another mountain. Precisely the kind of Western character that Stegner despised as a father, as a young man, and also despised historically. This model, which of course is not husbanding the resources of the West, it's exploiting them and destroying them. 3 years before he finishes it, he's sort of working in Iowa and he gets the word that his father has died. And he utters this incredible quote. He says, "Now I know how the novel ends."
The man whom today we consign to the grave is a man whom I and many others have condemned. We have sat in judgment on him. We have found him guilty of violence, brutality, willfulness. He broke the law. He blasphemed. He was completely incapable of anything remotely resembling social responsibility, and with dedicated selfishness, he went after the big money. He wore out his wife and broke her heart. He destroyed one son and turned the other against him. At the end, he degenerated into a broken old man, sponging a bare living, and sustaining himself on a last gilded and impossible dream.
This huge sprawling novel is not only kind of a purging of his father and an exorcism of this horrible memory of his life, but the whole book almost takes place in Salt Lake City, and he spends practically all of his time either outdoors or in the classroom. So it's also an incredibly loving embrace of Utah and the West. And in that sense, at age 34, he's published the most significant book of a very young life, and it's a breakthrough novel for him. From that moment on, critics and readers in America have heard of Wallace Stegner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Alex Beam is with us for the hour. Beam is a writer and journalist. He writes a column for the Boston Globe. Several years ago, he wrote a book about Joseph Smith called American Crucifixion. His new book is called Wallace Stegner, Dean of Western Writers.
I mean, I would say roughly half the people I talk to about this book, you know, haven't heard of Wallace Stegner. So sort of making him real, and I guess in the first few pages, I make the case for why he was an important writer. And of course, he was more than a writer, an important sort of figure in American cultural landscape. So that was the immediate task at hand. And if you could somehow bring the man or woman, you know, into the book, then I can start telling the story.
Hmm. When did you discover Wallace Stegner?
I actually had a fellowship at Stanford, and the cool kids, the kind of Western studies types out at Stanford, really admired his biography of John Wesley Powell called Beyond the 100th Meridian. Yeah. I had heard of him before that, but mainly because, like, in my generation, like, people used to carry thick novels in their backpacks. And I noticed everybody carried Angle of Repose, but I had never read it. I had heard it was a little bit boring, which I think it actually isn't. But I would say, you know, back east, Crossing to Safety is a very widely read book. His final novel, set in Vermont.
Yeah. I think you've said that's your favorite.
Yes. In my very short book, I kind of hammer that home repeatedly.
Yeah.
I love Crossing to Safety. And I mean, in terms of, you know, Stegner's life, which was a long life, it's crazy that his best novel was his last, at least in my view. It didn't win fancy awards. He won a Pulitzer Prize for Angle of Repose. He won a National Book Award for The Spectator Bird. But Crossing to Safety really endures. I've spoken about it. I have very profound feelings for it. And it's very, very successful novel.
I think it's interesting to that point, and this is something you mention in the book, that you refer to something his biographer Jackson Benson said, that Stegner had a great period, like a period where his stuff was just great. And these were in the last things that he wrote, in terms of his novels anyway. All of the Little Life things, Angle of Repose, The Spectator Bird, Crossing to Safety. Those four works, those were his, as Benson put it, his great period. And what do you think that means, that they came at the end? Because that doesn't often work with writers or great musicians. I mean, his daughter-in-law, and you mentioned this, said that he built his life sort of book by book, brick by brick, that it sort of gathered force over time. And so his greatness, at least from some people's perspective, came toward the end. What do you make of that?
Right. Well, well, it's a powerful message of human perfectibility, Doug. I think we can take that away from it. You know, Stegner was a very hard worker and a craftsman. You know, he compared himself to a beaver.
Yeah.
He felt he couldn't write. And I think a lot of sort of snobby people may have read Big Rock Candy Mountain, which is not that well written a book, you know, and kind of written him off. And a lot of his short stories are good, but not that much better than good. So, I mean, lest we forget, he was a preeminent teacher of fiction writing. And so, I mean, we have to assume that he taught himself, right? I mean, it is incredible and kind of stirring that you would think most great writers of the 20th century, you feel their hot period was in their 30s and maybe 40s. And Stegner really matured, but he had room to grow because he was a fairly raw writer as a young man. I mean, he really wrote for money in his 20s and 30s, which is a good reason. I mean, so did Dostoevsky, and Dostoevsky is a pretty good writer. But yeah. He got better, and God bless him. I hope we all get better.
You write early in the book that if there's a recurring theme in Stegner's work, it's his search for a home. Say what you mean about that generally. I mean, we'll talk about how his circumstances contributed to that here in a moment. But this idea of home— say something about that.
I mean, I actually, hilariously, I wanted the subtitle of this book to be Homeward Bound, because after I spent the time researching his life, I came to realize he did kind of see himself as an orphan. His mother had mental and emotional problems. His father was a basically just a career criminal in a certain sense. Stegner, yes, he's always overt about wanting a home. And as you know, for most of his life, I mean, one accusation that can be leveled at Stegner is that he wrote the same thing a lot. He would revisit themes either for money or for other reasons. So, I mean, he wrote many odes to Salt Lake City about how it was sort of his claimed home, his beloved home. Even though he wasn't born there, it was the first place he lived where he felt, you know, genuinely embraced by the culture. And secondarily, of course, he was an adolescent and a young man there. It's like in the way that we're, some of us are nostalgic for our college years or whatever. He really felt that he was a drifter, you know, a person without a home until his feet hit the soil in Utah. And then he developed this consciousness that lasted most of his life of being at home.
How do you describe his worldview? The way he saw the world that was reflected in his work. I mean, you say in the book he was born with a 19th century sensibility, and that like modern trends and hippies, as he described them, could really rankle him. We'll get to his crankiness toward the end of his life, but what was his worldview, do you think?
Well, he's old-fashioned, right? That's a phrase you don't hear much anymore. I think once he became of a certain age, once he lived into the 50s and 60s, I think he began to realize that he was old-fashioned. He claimed, I mean, fascinatingly, you know, pre-Salt Lake City, he lived a few years in southern Saskatchewan. Yeah. And he closely identified, interestingly, with the idea of the frontier. He felt that he was one of the last American writers writing in the middle of the 20th century who had a sensibility, at least about the frontier existing. Mm-hmm. And without getting into a huge parenthesis, I mean, that particular, you know, border used to be known as the Medicine Line, that line between Saskatchewan and the United States, where Native Americans would sometimes flee American arms and go into Saskatchewan to get sanctuary. So, I mean, Stegner knew all that, and he sort of identified with the growing nation, and he very much identified with the Intermountain West.
He had a successive discovery of homes. That's how you put it in the book. I mean, he went from home to home to home young. Sort of to understand this transient life, I suppose you have to understand his father, George. When Stegner was five, they joined their father, who was living in this derailed dining car. Talk about George and his sort of transient life that he imposed on his family.
Right. I mean, the whole novel, Big Rock Candy Mountain, is a long book, and it's a kind of a plaint, you know, complaint about his father, basically. But George Stegner was what was called a boomer or a main chancer. But his main thing was the score. Indeed, you know, that's what the title, The Big Rock Candy Mountain, was that Wallace Stegner thought that his dad was a dreamer in the worst sense of the word, that he was a get-rich-quick guy, that, you know, the kind of person Brigham Young didn't approve of, sort of continually out on the gold rush. And the reason they went to Saskatchewan was that George Stegner, who really had no particular background in farming, thought there was going to be a spike in wheat prices. So he bought 100 or 120 acres in Saskatchewan and set himself up as a wheat farmer, which didn't work out at all. But he started rum running, basically, you know, across the border. He started smuggling alcohol, which was very cheap in Canada, down to the United States. And to make a long story short, he found a market for
sure. Yeah, he did. He made a living.
Yes, he made a living selling alcohol in the land of the Mormons.
Yeah.
That was criminal activity. And so he kept moving one step ahead of the law. And Wallace felt it. And as I write in the book, I mean, at the same time that he was going to middle school, elementary school, and high school, you know, Mormon families were kind of embracing, you know, he would meet a pal, and the pal would say, well, come over to our house for supper. And then, you know, I'd say, well, come play basketball. you know, at the church. Mm-hmm. And Stegner was imbibing all that up against the background of essentially an absent and criminal father. I mean, we should really, in a sense, skip to the end because...
Yeah, let me put... This is how you put it in the book. The end of George Stegner's life was demonic.
Yes. George Stegner, I guess all in one day, purchased a handgun, checked into a hotel with a woman of loose morals. I mean, who really knows much about her? And then shot her dead and then committed suicide. And Stegner was a young academic at the time. He was profoundly unmoved when he got the news.
You write about how his friend, Stegner's friend, a man named Thomas Watkins, said that, let me just quote this from the book, Stegner would spend much of his life trying to exorcise the pain his father had caused him by using literature as therapy, writing him out of my system, as Stegner apparently put it. Which is interesting because when you, again, we were talking before, that does tend to go back to these same kinds of themes, and maybe that helps explain it. This is therapy for him, working out all of that.
Right. I mean, the publication of Big Rock Candy Mountain was an epical event for Stegner. I'd be hard pressed, I think, to look at other works of his that engaged so deeply with his father, with a father figure. After he wrote that book, he had a very successful marriage. His marriage was a commentary, of course, on his father. Like, he would never dream of treating a woman the way his father treated his mother. There's no suggestion that he was a player in any sense. I mean, because he was driven into this incredible, you know, these old-fashioned values in part by his father's heinous example.
Alex Beam. His new book is called Wallace Stegner, Dean of Western Writers. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, where shoppers can share some holiday cheer this season by purchasing a gift card during the Harmon's Holiday Gift Card Sale. In stores only November 28th through December 1st.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Wallace Stegner. The writer Alex Beam has written a compact biography that, in part, explores how Stegner's experience in Utah shaped his writing about the West. Stegner wrote memoirs and novels and histories about the place. He wrote in sweeping terms about its beauty, but also how it had been disfigured by the myths of individualism and endless possibility. Beam says Stegner's ideas were filtered through his experience growing up in Salt Lake City and his life among the Mormons. His book is called Wallace Stegner, Dean of Western Writers. Let's come back to his relationship with Utah, with Salt Lake. You mentioned in the book, this is where he matured from an adolescent to a young man. It's kind of where he comes of age. And as you say, the parts where his frail mother, his criminal father, where they failed to raise him. You said this is where the Mormons stepped in. He would go to what was it that he said? He said he would run himself ragged in Mormon ward houses. Did a lot of church basketball, which I think is familiar to a lot of people. But he says that the thing he wanted most was to belong. And I guess that's what these Mormon relationships gave to him, was a sense of belonging.
Absolutely. It's funny because one of the, I think a grandniece of the Irvine family sought me out at a public appearance I gave on the Stegner book in Salt Lake City and said, because the Irvines were really the family that sort of adopted the young Wallace. And she said, you know, you got this wrong about my grandparents. They weren't Mormons. But I call them Jack Mormons, you know, which for me, a non-Mormon, is always a tough term to sort of correctly parse out.
Well, Stegner loved Jack Mormons, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Stegner absolutely loved Jack Mormons. I guess he had plenty of exposure to them. But there's no doubt, and I don't mean to call out the Irvines because there were other families he was also close to. But, I mean, look, it's the familyness among everything. I mean, I don't have to talk to you or anyone in Salt Lake City about familyness, you know, when it comes to the stated values of the Mormon Church. And Stegner loved that. He didn't have a family, and he just loved the embrace. It's funny, I said to a friend, he never set foot in a Mormon church. And then someone said, well, wait a minute, you said he played basketball. And I actually didn't know that the basketball took place in the church.
Oh, yeah. But it gets to the point, though, that he had this abiding respect for Latter-day Saints as a people. He respected them as a sort of a collective group with a larger idea of the world and their place in the West. Eschewing individualism, working together, that like seemed like that. But he didn't buy the story of Mormonism. He didn't like it as a religious idea. And I'm guessing they probably tried to baptize him, but didn't work, I guess.
Yeah, he wasn't a religious person. It's important to understand that, in that he didn't go to Unitarian Church in Greensboro, Vermont. You know, he was no Episcopalian in Cambridge. So, I mean, oddly, although, again, he didn't bore people with his religious views, whatever they were. I mean, they probably were just naturalistic or humanistic or agnostic. He was polite, but he would say, you know, no, I don't believe the revelations, and, you know, end of story.
It's interesting that he, as you say, he was polite. But his impressions of Mormonism are interesting, that you write about. In Mormon Country, he said the exorcism of devils was commonplace among the Mormons for a number of years. He noted this belief in second sight and this, you know, penchant for speaking in tongues, for water witching and walkers after death, those kinds of things. And it's interesting, the impression that he writes, and you include this, he describes it, the Mormonism, as being shot through, this is Stegner's words, shot through with a theology that to outsiders looks like the wildest superstition. Describes it as a complicated web, a product, as he puts it, of ignorance and witchcraft of the frontier, pseudoscience, of amateur anthropologists and sociologists, the ignorance and superstition of the underprivileged people of Europe who became converts. That's a sort of biting sort of impression of the Latter-day Saints that end up in the Salt Lake Valley.
Yeah, no, that's harsh. I mean, he's a smart guy, right? I mean, he's a perceptive guy. So even though, curiously, he had a bit of, I know I quote him saying something nice about Joseph Smith, but he wasn't really that fond of Joseph Smith. I mean, it was, he admired, you know, Brigham Young as kind of this administrative empire builder. Well, there you have it. I mean, Mormon Country is a, and people might want to take a look at it. It's a very loose book. It's not a history. It's kind of a travelogue. Some of it's fiction, but it is an early appreciation of, I guess, what I sometimes call the Mormon culture zone. I know other people call it that too, but it's an early appreciation for, I also sort of call it Deseret, for, I mean, the amazing cultural impact of Deseret. Mm-hmm. In that section of the West.
I want to ask about his time at the University of Utah. It gets us back to sort of, he was coming of age. He sort of loved the place. There's this nice thing he writes about how his friends at the University of Utah and his teachers gave him this sort of entree into the, as he put it, the human world, taught him how to belong. Again, that idea of belonging introduced him to the life of the mind, even though he says he didn't quite know what that meant necessarily. So I guess if you look at the scope of his life, his literary career, his teaching, his advocacy for wilderness and those things, could you say that it was Salt Lake that shaped and defined his point of view?
100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely no doubt. I mean, I'm an East Coast jerk, you know, so I have no perception of BYU and the U. It's a very warm encomium, you know, to that university at that time, and really to all universities. He's such a hungry mind. I mean, every university in the world would love to have a young Wallace Stegner.
It's interesting hearing him talk reading Stegner write about his affection for this place. How, as he says, even though I didn't know it then, I realized it was the place I most wanted to live. And it, I guess I was surprised he didn't stay. Did he ever think about that? You know, living the, settling in as a Gentile in the land of the Latter-day Saints. Did, do you think he, I don't know, I thought maybe he thought about, this is it for me. I'm going to make my life here.
Briefly, he does return to the U as a teacher after right. he gets his PhD yep. at the University of Iowa. I think, and some of this is sort of subsumed a tiny bit in Crossing to Safety, but I mean, he doesn't have the luxury. I'm sure the University of Utah is not offering him, it's the middle of the Depression. I'm sure they're not offering him tenure. You know, he ends up, he goes to a Christian place where he's basically thrown out of, I mean, he needs work badly and he needs money badly. He goes to the University of Wisconsin. He has a young wife, a young child. I think every career decision he makes in his 20s and early, mid-30s is based on money. You know, he probably needs $2,500 or $2,800 a year. He's writing for money. It's funny, you put your finger on something very interesting, which is that from a certain age on, he's governed by a huge nostalgia or purported nostalgia for Salt Lake City in Utah, but he doesn't choose to return there. I mean, jumping ahead, he does, however, choose, he makes a big career decision to return to the West yeah. when he goes to Palo Alto. And, you know, just to open a parenthesis, when you talk about the great age of Stegner's writing, I think a great book is Recapitulation, a very unusual book where he goes back fictionally and revisits Salt Lake City.
I want to say something about the Big Rock Candy Mountain, have you talk about it. You mentioned it comes from his father's, this is how you put it, delirious faith and success, American style. But it seems like this book changed his life. Is that fair to say?
Well, it did. I mean, again, this was on a lot of levels. It was the exorcism. It was his probably successful attempt to write it all down, you know, the story of his father and his mother and their life in Salt Lake City. I guess there's scenes at Salt Air there. You know, it's this whole profound appreciation of his life in the valley.
You get a sense, I should say, for those who know the smell of the lake. He brings some of those senses to the book. There is, I think, for a lot of people here anyway, a kind of familiarity in that way.
Yeah, it's quite something. I don't know. I feel bad running it down. I apologize. I feel that he becomes a somewhat more sophisticated writer. I feel Big Rock Candy Mountain is kind of sort of, it's hard to say, it's sort of writing. He's sort of hammering away at the typewriter. It took him a long time to write. I think it's his first novel that's reviewed by the New York Times. I think it's the novel that sort of puts him on the map.
It is, and I think the reaction to it is really interesting, which sort of gets to a larger theme in his life, maybe. It was the Sunday Times book review, and it was a man by the name of Joseph Beach. And he wrote this, going from your book here, Stegner's latest book shows great advance in power and grasp over the shorter novels for which he is chiefly known. And here's the key part, and is a much more satisfying example of regional fiction. And then this is what you put in right after that. Ouch. Like just damning with kind of faint praise. And what do you make of that? Because maybe it seems as though the critical reaction to it did reveal what seems to be the beginning of a sense that how could he live up to the greater writers? That this was a piece of regional, good, decent, but an example of regional fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, ouch. Ouch indeed. I mean, it's funny, you know, he famously appeared on a New York Times Magazine cover story about Western writers, and they called him William Stegner, which, you know, he just always felt kind of slighted by East Coast taste masters, although there was certainly a much more narrow perception in the literary world back then. I mean, basically, there was sort of the New York Times and everybody else. I think when he gets the Pulitzer Prize for Angle of Repose, at least for like a 6-month period, he's able to sort of genuinely sit back and enjoy it and realize that at least for that brief time. Now, of course, there's a whole withholding story there. The New York Times feels he didn't deserve the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
But I know he saw that, you know, as a vindication, as a genuine elevation of him to the ranks of great national writers. I mean, it really didn't last. I mean, as I know, you know, his publisher had a lot of trouble selling some of his subsequent books, et cetera, et cetera.
It's kind of disappointing in some way when you come to know, as you write about it in the book, what he put into that book. You mentioned Stegner saying, I see it as one of the most personal, you know, books that he had written. I wrote it because it happened to me. And he wrote this. He said, a lot of myself is invested in that book. As I wrote some pages of it, I couldn't see the typewriter for tears.
Well, yes. But if you read that book, you know exactly what he's talking about. I mean, this does kind of get to this mimetic question, you know, is Stegner really a great fiction writer, or is he just really a great autobiographer? Yeah, because there's nothing in that book that, in a sense, isn't real to him.
Let's talk about his vision of the West that seems to have been shaped by his experience in Utah. Do you think his observations of Utah and of the Mormon settlers also shaped what he thought of the West in terms of its limitations, in terms of its potential?
Well, as you said earlier, the contrast for him was the kind of the exploiters like his father, you know, the people who went into the hills to hunt for gold and maybe ripped down half a hillside, didn't find any gold and moved on. Now, I don't want to hold myself out as an expert, you know, on Brigham Young's colonization of the Salt Lake Valley, such as that. But I mean, the thing that Stegner loved and wrote about repeatedly and admired about the Mormons was husbandry and stewardship.
Yeah.
You know, these were really important words to him. And, you know, stripping the Western landscape to find something that may or may not be there meant nothing to him. To him, it was about, you know, these are tough places to live. They're super challenging. And if people don't get together and dam that little creek, you know, and share the water rather than fight over it. And, you know, he did love and admire the communitarian ethos of Mormon settlements. And he wrote about them forever and ever.
He said that Mormons were stickers. They came to live on the land and not exploit it and move on. At least they stuck around. And this was also interesting. This is something you mentioned in the book. That this comes from his book, Mormon Country. The Mormon village is a green village. It was unthinkable that the gathering place of the saints should be a barren desert. It should be made to blossom, and it was just a reference to that idea. But what did he make of the – I mean, he was impressed by Latter-day Saint settlers in terms of their abilities to irrigate a desert. But he also knew a lot – and we'll get to John Wesley Powell here in a second – but this was an arid place. He also wrote about it being very limited by its lack of water. So what do you make of that part of the way he thought about the West?
Well, again, mapping his own views onto Powell, though Powell, of course, lived well before Stegner. I mean, he found his soulmate in Powell's views. Huh. I mean, they felt the West was improperly mapped, I mean, to start with. I mean, they felt the West was defined by watersheds, not by political boundaries.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole thing for Stegner was sort of, you know, proper use of the arid lands, basically. And he had no disdain for the arid lands, but he knew it wasn't like the black soil of Kansas. But Stegner just, I think he thinks they're, to be blunt, I think he thinks they're the only American culture that made a success of the vast tracts of the West, east of California and west of the 100th Meridian.
Alex Beam. His new book is called Wallace Stegner, Dean of Western Writers. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the author and journalist Alex Beam. We're talking about his new book, Wallace Stegner, Dean of Western Writers.
Stegner gave a few interviews to an historian, Richard Etchalane.
Etchalane.
He gave a few interviews. And I think one of them that he mentions is really interesting, that he says, I suppose that I'm constantly trying to bear in mind that having been very lucky, I'm also very responsible, and that the only thing that makes civilization go forward is the responsibility of individuals. He writes about all of us having this obligation to have some kind of concern for the species and for the culture and, this, as he said, the larger things outside of ourselves. Would you say something about that and talk a little bit about his that sense of obligation and his view of wilderness? He writes this wilderness letter in 1960. How did he see the idea of conservation and protection and those things?
Well, again, I guess he saw it in what we now would call somewhat old-fashioned way. I mean, it's hard to cast one's mind back, you know, to the sort of the Ansel Adams period of the Sierra Club, the earlier years of the Sierra Club, when they themselves were, of course, the inheritors of Pinchot and Roosevelt. I mean, the idea of setting aside vast portions of the country, in this case, the West. I would say, and he would say, that that was sort of an old-fashioned civics idea, right? That the proper way to stand on the earth is to not only stand on it, but be aware that you're going to have to, you know, send the earth forward to subsequent generations. That was probably inculcated into him as a young man in Salt Lake City, and it, you know, his first years afterwards in the West. I mean, he only lived in the East for 7 or 8 years and really hated it, basically. He did have a very sort of old-fashioned view of wilderness spaces that shouldn't be touched. You know, there's been a lot of rethinking of all of this that's sort of purportedly layered on various sophisticated analyses, et cetera, et cetera. But he and you know, the Udalls, the Department of the Interior, et cetera, et cetera. The early Kennedy years had a much more kind of, at least they tried to cling to a somewhat simpler view of, let's save these places the way they are. Of course, I mean, with the dam building programs and things like that, that simply wasn't possible. You know, with the desperate need for energy, things were going to be changing. But in a way, the dream that he articulated, I think it was a dream of classic preservation and conservation.
I wanted to come back to Crossing to Safety. Will you just say a little bit about what that book is about? And we can talk about your own sort of relationship with it, your own affection for it. This is your favorite of his work.
It's Stegner's final novel, and quote unquote, all it is the story of two couples. And it's really the story of two couples who make their way through life. From they meet as young academics raising babies in Madison, Wisconsin, which is in a sense where Wallace and Mary Stegner met Phil Gray and his wife. It's about the Stegners and the Grays who became friends. The Grays invited them to Greensboro, Vermont, to come stay with them, and Stegner eventually built a house. So in other words, again, we see this incredible overlap of Stegner's quote-unquote real life with the fictional life as it's told in Crossing to Safety. So it follows these two couples really for 30 or 40 years. Stegner indeed spent every summer in Greensboro, Vermont, next door to the Grays. And so it's about their evolution as couples, as people. And then, so there's four principles, and one of them is dying. A fictional character named Chastity is dying, which sort of prompts everyone, it's really a four-handed play in a way, and it prompts every character to have to reconsider how the four of them have gotten along over time. The quick thing I'd like to say about Crossing to Safety is that I'm now of the age that the protagonists are. They were, in a sense, sort of just post-retirement. Mm. But I really liked this book 30 years ago when I first read it, and I find that it's not necessarily an older or more mature person's book. I think young people enjoy it too. It's just very successful. It's very human. You know, it doesn't build anything incredible. I think it's one of the most human books I've ever read.
There's a section from Crossing to Safety that you include. I think it's important to understand that they were geese. Will you read this and talk about it, if you would?
Suddenly, there they are, a wavering V headed directly over our hilltop, quite low, beating southward down the central flyway and talking as they pass. We stay quiet, suspending our human conversation until their garrulity fades and their quavering lines are invisible in the sky. They have passed over us like an eraser over a blackboard, wiping away whatever was there before they came. That's all it is. I mean, it's somebody, you know, in the Vermont landscape. You see other passages like this. This is sort of an American trope, you know. It's in Deer Hunter when they see the deer for the first time and everybody stops in awe. I mean, it's sort of Americans' sort of realization that they're living in a natural world. And this is a very Stegnerian sort of, you know, moment out of time where when the geese pass above them, it's a suspended moment, you know, that human time stops and the susurrus, as some people call it, the whispering of the geese wings is sort of the only thing that you can perceive.
What do you see in that? Why did you include that in your book?
Well, first of all, I think it's gorgeous lyrical writing, and I know I have another passage in the book when his former student Ken Kesey is heaping mud all over Stegner. I kind of include another passage that's kind of very, very beautiful and naturalistic, because I think that is great writing. I mean, to answer a question that you asked me much, much earlier, and that I answered honestly, I said that Stegner is capable of great writing. I mean, none of us is doing great writing all the time. But when he wrote great writing, he was very, very great.
Let's talk a little bit about his last years. I guess it would be fair to say he just becomes kind of grumpy. Had a short fuse, held a grudge, didn't like that his reputation wasn't being recognized or holding up. He dedicates the Marriott Library at the University of Utah in 1969, says some really critical things about it seems to be just the universe. Like, you know, this is not a great age of books. He was annoyed by the younger generation. He just sounds like kind of an annoyed conservative in some ways. What do you make of that last part of his life?
Yeah, you know, I wish it were different. that's really what I make of it, in the sense that it's not, I mean, the worst of it really, it starts in Palo Alto in the late 60s. I can't explain it. I mean, I wish I could, but he starts engaging in very untoward behavior. You know, he's sort of the big dog in Palo Alto. He's running the Stegner Fellowship. Yes, he's amazing. Students like McMurtry and Ken Kesey. And then, you know, Stanford starts inviting prestigious writers from the East to come. That's what Stanford does. You know, and he gets a bug under his saddle. He goes, you know, I don't want these experimental writers from New York here. And then I'm sure Stanford wouldn't like me saying this, but, you know, I mean, the protests migrate really from East, you know, so you get these student protests in Stanford, 69, 70, 71, and Stegner just can't abide it. He has no fuse. I don't quite get it. I mean, a lot of kids were genuinely upset and about things and questioning everything. And Stegner, I guess, proved to be a culturally very, very conservative and really you know, abandoned Stanford in a huff, which is an outrage, because Stanford, just like Salt Lake City, but Stanford gave him a lot. Stanford gave him a prestigious fellowship where he only had to work half time. You know, they named it after him. He had the beautiful house in the Los Altos Hills. I mean, so it's crazy that he sort of doesn't get the men and women going to college in the late 60s and early 70s. And he yanks his papers out of Stanford. That's why he's at the Marriott Library. That's why his papers are at the Marriott Library now. And he writes just a lot of unfortunate stuff about, you know, people like Mailer and James Baldwin and Gore Vidal. And it's kind of borderline sort of homophobic, you know, these people in New York, everyone thinks they're great, but they're not. I mean, I think I'm one of the most resentful people I know, but I mean, I try to keep a handle on it, you know, because it's just very unbecoming. And especially, I mean, we're bumping up against a point that you keep exploring in a very interesting way, is that, I mean, why is he not comfortable in his own greatness? Because maybe he isn't so great if he himself is uncomfortable about his status.
I think it's interesting to sort of come back to the idea that you mentioned early on for him, having gone from home to home to home to home, looking for a place to belong, looking for a sense of home. It doesn't seem like he ever found it. I mean, he chooses Greensboro, Vermont as his final resting place. He warms to, this is how you put it in the book, warms to so-called traditional New England values, I guess sort of adopts them. But then you also write that, unlike the arid West, which could become a dust bowl after only brief exposure to civilization, Vermont could heal itself. You could cut down the trees and they grow back. This country wants to be trees, Stegner said, you know, with admiration. And it kind of seems like a jab at the West in some way. I don't know. What do you make of that finally?
Well, I mean, I sort of agree with you. I say in the book, because I believe it to be true, you know, that this is his final home. I mean, that he somehow, after recapitulation, which again, in a way, is exercising Salt Lake City, I suppose, or at least it's a final farewell to Salt Lake City. Right. He feels that he's standing in Vermont soil, that that's now where his life is grounded.
But was it?
Gee whiz, you're making me think about my own life. You know, I have an adopted life here in Boston. Yeah. I mean, people would say this is my life. Yeah, I would say yes. I mean, if his greatest novel is there, this sort of lyrical triumph, that novel appeared 6 or 7 years before he died. So he continued living half time, say, in Vermont after that. I don't know. Maybe that's almost a religious question in a way. You know, I know that Christians, of whom I'm one, you know, often talk about, you know, God calling us home. So our only real home, in a sense, is the home from which we came, the home we can't know. But I stand by what I wrote. You know, I think that he defaulted into Vermont at the end of his life.
Finally, I guess, let me ask you, people, as you've encountered, certainly where you are, don't really know who Wallace Stegner. Many don't know who Wallace Stegner is. I'm sure you find people around here, as you did, not quite sure, have a vague sense of maybe who he was. And I think you probably agree with some of the others you quote in the book who say, that's a shame that more people should. I guess I would ask, for those who don't know Wallace Stegner, what should they read? I mean, outside of your book or others, right? But what should they read of his that'll give us a sense of this kind of complicated person?
Well, I mean, certainly the way to walk into it and to be convinced that you're reading the work of a great writer is to read Crossing to Safety because it's approachable and readable. I think probably his other greatest book really is the John Wesley Powell biography, which is not for everyone, but it's a major work of Western history, And then thirdly, people should read Angle of Repose, which is a large and complicated book. But at the end of the day, it's quite a successful book. Those are three very strong works in my view.
Alex Beam, thank you very much.
Doug, thanks for having me. It's very fun to talk about Stegner.
Alex Beam. He's a writer and journalist, has a regular column in the Boston Globe. His new book is called Wallace Stegner, Dean of Western Writers. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. We had help this week from the actor Mark Fossen. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.